out. And there's nothing you can do about it if you're going to raise that.
There it is right there.
1 o'clock being here.
Are they on?
Yeah, they're on. Let's get the meeting called to order. Let everyone get settled down here. We called this, set this meeting up today for, and after we set it up, Senator Pappas asked me if she could join, so the senator and the Senate's here with us. And basically what we did is last session during the, when we were hearing bills, we had a lot of bills, and there was a lot of questions about why they have to go this rulemaking, why they want to do that rulemaking, the process that we have. And so I figured this would be a good way for the members, a lot of the members on this committee are fairly new or new to this committee, and give them an idea of what rule, how our rulemaking process is supposed to go and why we go certain ways on it. So that's what we're holding the hearing about. And with that, like I said, we can get started here. And if the people who are doing the presentation have asked that is to let them finish their presentation, and then we'll have time after each one is done to ask them questions. So the first person on our agenda for today is Patricia Wingett.
Winget.
I wrote it down that way, and I said it wrong. But anyway, Winget. And she's going to give a presentation on the rulemaking process. And so, Ms. Winget, if you want to go from here.
Thank you. Yes, I'm Patricia Winget. I'm an attorney and rules coordinator for the Minnesota Department of Health, and I also edit the Minnesota Rulemaking Manual. Mr. Chairman, members of the House, Senators, thank you for inviting me. I'm very pleased to provide you with an overview of the rulemaking process under the Minnesota Administrative Procedure Act, Chapter 14, and I'll also refer to that act as the APA. As you know, the legislature grants authority to state agencies to propose and adopt rules, a process that can take 18 to 23 months. And I'm here to answer two important questions for you. What happens between the time the agency receives that rulemaking authority and it adopts a final rule? And then the second question is, well, why does it take so long? The short answer is that it's complex and difficult to make a good rule. These subject areas are very specialized and the details are complex. Agencies must notify and engage the public in a meaningful way so that they can participate in developing the rules, and an agency can benefit from the public's expertise. The agencies have to build consensus on lots of controversial points. So putting it all together, an enforceable rule takes time, effort, and skill. And I'm going to walk you through that process and explain them to you, each step. First, what is a rule? Here's what a rule is. In simple language, it's a general statement that the agency adopts for its future purpose to make the rule, to make the law it enforces or administers more specific, or to govern the agency's organization or procedure. By formally adopting the rules, we gain certainty because the agency's course is made definite, predictability because the public is then going to know what the agency will do, and consistency because the agency must treat like situations in a like manner. For example, the Minnesota Department of Transportation regulates special transportation services. It's very important that our elderly and disabled people get the special care and attention that they need. People want the person driving their loved ones to be safe and qualified. So the Department of Transportation takes care of this in several ways. It establishes and maintains a list of disqualifying crimes that eliminate certain people from being drivers. And its commercial vehicle inspectors ensure the safety and quality of the special transportation services, vehicles, and drivers. Now, the Administrative Procedures Act has some values that are built into it, and these pedestals represent four of them. The first three are the major values that go into rules development, and they're a part of every rulemaking process, and I'll get to flexibility in a moment. The first part is public participation, which I already mentioned. But this is the public's need to influence the process and the agency's need to have the public's perspective and advice. The next value is agency expertise. The legislature tells the agency to figure out the details and accomplish an aim because the legislature does not have either the expertise or the time to acquire that expertise. And putting the details in often entails very specific standards. So the agencies can determine the details because they have the specialized knowledge on the subject involved. The agency has scientists, planners, engineers, professionals, all manner of accomplished people who can evaluate the latest research and development and engage the parties who are the most affected, the scientific communities, the manufacturers, the environmentalists, and anyone else who is interested to develop a sound rule. The rulemaking process provides a more deliberate and deliberative process than does legislation. And that's why the legislature sets broad policy and the agencies take care of the details. Okay, back to our pedestals. The third pedestal is independent oversight. In Minnesota, we have an independent office of hearing examiners that oversee the process for form and legality. They conduct our hearings. They make sure the agencies have complied with all the APA requirements and standards. The office was created in 1975. It's called the Office of Administrative Hearings, or OAH. And it was started to respond to criticism of previous practices of agency staff. Before there was an OAH, the agencies conducted their own hearings. This led to a perception of agency bias and other complaints about the lack of procedural consistency in the hearing process. The fourth pedestal is flexibility. The definition of rules includes new rules, amended rules, and repealed rules. And the APA anticipates that the full rulemaking procedure that I'm talking about is not necessary for every update or change in an agency's rules. For these circumstances, the APA has built in some abbreviated methods, expedited, exempt, and emergency rules. The method used depends on the circumstances and the character of the rules needed. I'm only mentioning them to represent the flexibility that they provide. Later this afternoon, other agencies will specifically address these types of rules. Okay, this chart represents the process from beginning to end in its broadest terms, and it's color-coded to show how the process is divided up among the governor's office, official public notice and comment periods, our rule and sonar development, OAH oversight, and our final steps. In a typical, this chart shows the steps in chronological order, but the process is not usually so simple and straightforward. Much of the work takes place in an overlapping and concurrent way, and sometimes the steps need to be repeated. Every project and agency is different. In a typical rulemaking, developing the rules and taking all the steps to propose them for adoption can take up to 18 months. After an agency formally proposes the rules, it can take another 3 to 5 months to conclude them. 3 months if there's no hearing, 5 months if there is. And at the end, we come out with a rule that reflects the latest facts and evidence. It reflects the public will to regulate the subject and is enforceable. The next step requires the agency and governor's office to communicate with each other. Here, the agency notifies the governor's office that it's planning to adopt rules. It describes the scope of its authority, who the supporters are, who the opponents are, and whether the rule is controversial. Next is the request for comments. The request for comments is a document that's published in the state register, and rulemaking officially commences under the Administrative Procedures Act with this publication. This document notifies the public that the agency is planning to do rulemaking and discloses the topic. It might also ask for public input on questions that the agency must answer later in its regulatory analysis. But the state register is legal notice. I'm not acquainted with anybody that reads the state register on a regular basis. But it's very important. But there are people that do. Nevertheless, the agency is obligated to get the notice out in an actual form to reach the people that are affected. And it does this by identifying the stakeholders itself and notifying whatever trade groups there might be involved, other professional associations, any way that it can to get the word out to the public. Agencies now usually have a service for people to sign up for frequent notice of changes to follow the process. Now, the public has at least 60 days to provide comments under this formal comment period. And the people can do this by communicating with the agency by phone, fax, email, online, and some agencies are even using social media. For example, the Department of Health just published its request for comments for rules about bored geothermal heat exchangers. These are heating systems that pull heat or used to cool buildings by pulling, it works through running a closed loop into the ground. And these pipes transfer the heat to or from the surrounding earth. The department has jurisdiction over this because these systems could affect the groundwater that we use for drinking. Next is developing the rules and justifying them. And this is the biggest, most time-consuming, most important part. And this part also might start before the agency publishes its request for comments. This is the stage where the agency gathers all of the evidence and studies that it's relying on for its regulatory framework. It gathers the opinions and advice of the stakeholders. It consults with experts both inside and outside state government. Every situation is different, but always the agency must engage the public. Agencies often hold informal informational meetings to get the word out. A good first step is getting a draft of rules out to the public as well. Rules are usually drafted with the help of an advisory committee. Advisory committees serve in a representative capacity. That is, they're usually chosen to represent specific interest groups by staying on top of the issues and letting their constituents know the ideas and concern. The committee holds the information that the agency needs to make its rules workable. The committee neither writes the rules nor negotiates them, but it holds the power of persuasion. And this power of persuasion is really important. If the committee can persuade the agency that its method is the right way to go, then the agency has every reason to adopt it. Rule drafting requires working with the revisor's office to put the details into enforceable regulatory language that meet the same standards that legislation does. The committee makes recommendations to the agency, and if there are controversies that the agencies cannot resolve with its advisory committee, the commission or board makes the decisions. The main goal is to achieve consensus on as many issues as possible. And even if there's disagreement remaining on some issues, the question is whether the agency has made the rules as workable as possible for those who have to comply with them. At the same time that the agency is drafting rules, it's also writing its statement of need and reasonableness, which we also call the SONAR. Now, a few words about the SONAR. It's an important historical, legal, and evidentiary document. It's also very technical, and it can be quite long. The agency must meet many requirements, but the most important parts are the background information that summarizes the evidence that the agency relies on and the rule-by-rule analysis. So you have 50 pages in your hand, and you're trying to figure out what to do with them. There's always an introduction, and there's always a rule-by-rule analysis. In this document, the agency explains the considerations that it took into account in making its decisions, and it has to explain why it chose one idea over another, which means disclosing the ideas that it rejected and why it rejected those. This is where the agency explains its rationale for each part of its proposed rules and why each is necessary and reasonable, which is the legal standard that each rule must meet. Pulling all this together requires the rules and the SONAR to be developed simultaneously. If the agency ended up with a very pristine, elegant, finished rule, and then had to go back and reconstruct all of the arguments that went into it. That's a task that no agency really wants to face. Because of Minnesota's strong rules and process, when the controversies are resolved, the rule goes into effect, and it's extremely rare for anyone to challenge the rules in court. I just was looking at a Texas Law Review article where the author was writing with the expectation that the rules would then go into litigation, and their APA had to accommodate a post-rule process of litigation, and a state court would have to judge on the rules. This does not happen often in Minnesota, practically never, because we resolve our controversies either during the rule and sonar development or later in the process after a hearing. So the agency's drafted rules and written a sonar and must then again communicate with the governor's office. At this stage, the agency submits its proposed rule and sonar to the governor's office for its approval. After the governor's office approves the rules, the agency publishes a notice of intent to adopt rules in the state register. Again, legal notice, and again, the agency must get actual notice out to the affected parties, those who will be substantially affected by the rules, the stakeholders, the trade associations, and others who will pass the word along to their constituents. And again, there's this public comment period, this time of at least 30 days. But this time, the agency collects those comments in written form. So you have to submit your comments either in writing, by traditional letter, or email. These comments are collected as part of the official rule record that it will submit to an administrative law judge for review. We have three options for notice here. One is the notice of intent to adopt rules with a hearing, the notice of intent to adopt rules without a hearing, and then there's a combination form we call a dual notice. First, let's talk about a hearing. If the proposed rule is controversial or 25 people request a public hearing, the agency will hold one. In this case, an ALJ, an administrative law judge appointed by the Office of Administrative Hearing, conducts the hearing. The ALJ sits at a table similar to this one, and then the room is set up with a small table for a few agency people to sit, and there's probably a court reporter taking down the proceedings to prepare a transcript after the fact. The agency has a very limited role in this process. The agency, first the ALJ opens the hearing and explains the process to everybody who's attending, and then turns it over to the agency. The agency provides a little bit of background information, and then introduces all of the documents that it's collected as part of the process as exhibits and turns those over to the ALJ for review. Then it's the public's turn to speak. The agency's part in this is very limited because the agency's already spoken for the sonar. Public comments are then listened to, all comments. The ALJ determines how long people can speak and allows everyone to speak. When everyone's had their say, then the ALJ closes the hearing by announcing how long the post-hearing comment will be and makes some other similar logistic statements. So usually there's a 21-day post-hearing comment followed by a 5-day rebuttal period. This means that the agency takes all the comments that it received during the 30-day comment period, the comments made at the hearing, and any comments received after the hearing, and responds to those comments. People who have attended the hearing can submit further information, or people who didn't attend the hearing can submit information. All of that is collected and posted on the agency's website. Then there's a 5-day rebuttal period for the parties to respond to anything else that's been presented since the hearing. Another thing to mention about a hearing is that it can take place over several times in venues. So a hearing can be conducted for one rule project in several places in the state, and sometimes this happens. For example, the Minnesota Department of Education recently adopted social studies standards, a complex topic with lots of public involvement in a hearing. Now, social studies is academically complex because there's so many topics that it encompasses. Civics, government, geography, U.S. history, world history, economics. And the department set high standards for its K-12 learners. It also wanted to allow local school districts flexibility for achieving them. It worked with teachers, college instructors, national experts, parents, business and community representatives. And a standards review committee also met regularly. The department received thousands of comments. After the hearing, the ALJ approved the rule without recommending changes, and the standards are in effect. Now, when an agency receives hundreds of comments or thousands of comments, it can't possibly respond to all of them individually. So it groups questions together by topic and figures out some kind of logical rationale and responds to them accordingly, collectively. Without a hearing, if a group of stakeholders is small and the agency has reached consensus on any controversies, the agency can adopt the rules without a hearing. 80% of proposed rules are adopted without a hearing. For example, the DNR has falconry rules. Falconry is hunting with birds of prey, and the number of active falconers in Minnesota is small, a little over 100 permit holders. The adopted rules reflect new federal standards. The notice of intent to adopt rules without a hearing, however, always contains the option of asking for a hearing, and if 25 people do, the agency has to start over with a notice of hearing. In this case, the Falconer's rules went forward without a hearing and are now in effect. I mentioned dual notice. This is when the agencies can hedge their bets a bit. The agency might think that it has resolved all the controversies, but is not sure. So therefore, it goes forward with what's called a notice of intent to adopt rules with a hearing, but if 25 people do not request a hearing, we'll cancel it and adopt rules without a hearing, and that's why we call it a dual notice. For example, the Minnesota Department of Health sets standards for carbon monoxide and nitrous dioxide levels in enclosed sports arenas where gas combustion engines are used. We believed that we had come up with the proper limits that would protect the health of figure skaters and hockey players in our ice arenas. After a long public proceeding, some very involved citizens still disagreed with our numbers, and they requested a hearing. We made our case to the ALJ, they made their case to the ALJ, and the ALJ ruled in our favor. Now, one comment about these very controversial things that I've mentioned. We can't avoid the controversies. This is the process we use for resolving them as best we can. And we can't satisfy every constituent and every concern. But by this process, everyone has had an opportunity to be heard, we hope. And people who have had an opportunity to be heard are more accepting of the final outcome. So, OAH review. Whichever form the notice takes, the agency submits all its documentation for the rule to an ALJ assigned to the case. The ALJ receives all the records and has 14 days to issue a report if there's no hearing and 30 days to issue a report after the hearing closes. The report that the ALJ issues rules on whether the agency has followed all of the procedural requirements. It identifies any defects in the rules. And the ALJ makes recommendations for correcting those defects. The ALJ also rules on whether the agency has shown that the rules are necessary and reasonable. Back to the governor's office. The agency makes any further changes after it receives the report and resubmits the rule to the governor's office for one last approval. Then there's some final steps to formally adopt and file the rule. The agency head signs an order adopting the rule and sends that to the Office of Administrative Hearings. The Office of Administrative Hearings requests 4 copies of the rule from the revisor's office and files them with the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State stamps them as filed and then serves one on the governor's office. This starts the governor's 14-day veto period. If the governor does not act in 14 days, the rule becomes law. Often the governor issues to the agency its intention to approve the rule, and the agency can then go forward. The last action that the agency must take is to publish the notice of adoption in the state register. In most cases, the rule becomes enforceable 5 days later. So that's the process. One quick review here. We're going to march right through this one. First, the agency notifies the governor's office that it intends to adopt a rule and the topic. The agency starts the formal process by publishing a request for comments, and there's a 60-day notice period. The agency then develops its rules and its statement of need and reasonableness. It submits those to the governor's office for approval. Then the agency proposes its rules, which includes a 30-day comment period. The agency can do this one of three ways. It can propose to adopt them with a hearing, without a hearing, or a dual notice if it's not certain. And whether there's a hearing or not, the Office of Administrative Hearing reviews the rules, issues a report. The governor's office takes one final look. The agency takes the final steps for finishing the rule. The Secretary of State serves the governor's office with the adopted rule. The governor's veto period expires. The agency publishes its notice of adoption. Voila, a finished rule. Okay, well, that answers the question of what happens to the time between the time the agency receives its rulemaking authority and a final rule is issued. Where does the time actually go? This chart shows in months where it goes in a typical rulemaking project. As you can see by the first bar of agency activity, that the agency is engaged from before the beginning of this process to after the end of it. The public participates much of the time as it works with the agency for creating the rule, and that's the second part. That lighter phase at the end of the green public participation bar represents when there's a hearing, the additional time. The revisor's office at the bottom shows that they must turn the agency's draft into enforceable rule language, and this can take some time depending on the complexity of the rule and whether the legislature's in session. As you know, the revisor's office is part of the legislature, and the legislature has priority for the revisor's office time. The governor's office takes some time to review and approve the rules, and then has a 45-day veto period. And OAH has independent oversight, but in terms of the overall time in adopting a rule, it's very small. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the House and Senators, for listening to my presentation. That wraps up my prepared explanation of the rulemaking process under the APA, and I have some time left for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Winget. One question that we figured it out, but what is SONAR?
SONAR, Statement of Need and Reasonableness.
And just so it's on the tape so people understand.
Yeah.
Any questions? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Winget. Thank you. At what points in the process does the public actually have the ability to change course of the development of the rule, change language, change, anything? I would suspect the OAH review oftentimes yields, you mentioned, a recommendation or a report from the judge. Does that actually include changing language and changing meaning, how can the public bear on it?
Ms. Winget.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, the public is involved from the beginning. As soon as the agency tells the public that it's adopting rules, it's soliciting comments, and the public can submit its comments to the agency at any time between the time the rule is finished. Between the time the rule is started, and very near the finish. But the agency has to be persuaded by the public. So there are many, many times for public input and suggestions, and they can serve on the committees, they can talk to agency staff, they can talk to people that represent their interests, they can request a hearing. You know, all of these steps involve public involvement. Can we go back to my last chart, please? This one. Yeah. So you see that green line across the top of the screen? That's all public participation. And they, if we get to the point of proposing a rule and the public is still not satisfied, then it can make its case to the administrative law judge, and the administrative law judge can consider what the public has to say as well. So, you know, it's an interactive process, but the agency will be making the decisions. So the public has the power of persuasion over the agency.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when the judge gives their report, how does that report interact with the continued direction of the agency around that rule?
Okay. Ms. Wingett.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, the report indicates whether the agency has any defects in the rule. It lists the controversies that were, the report is very detailed, and it explains the controversies that were a part of the consideration. And then it determines whether the agency has acted legally in making the decisions that it's made. And if it disagrees with the agency, then it can make finds that there's legal defect in the agency's proposals, then it can recommend changes. And then the agency can decide whether it's going to accept those changes or whether it has to pull the rule and start over, which it happens rarely, but it can happen.
Thank Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Wingett, this is just kind of a follow-up to Representative Drazkowski's question. You said an agency has to be persuaded by the public to make a change, and I'm wondering if you could maybe give some examples. I'm curious how often that happens. How often does an agency actually change direction based on what the public has to say, or is it mostly just lip service?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, it happens all the time. When agencies get together with the public, they sit down and they talk about the controversies and they work on consensus. I mean, that's how we get to a finished rule, is working through consensus to see if the parties can agree on a process that is acceptable to most of the people involved. So, for example, I mentioned the ICE arena rules. We had a very active member of the public who served on our advisory committee, and she persuaded the department to lower the emission standards that we had originally proposed for carbon monoxide and nitrous dioxide in the from our original proposal, and we lowered it. Now, that's an example. And then also the arena managers came in with some suggestions, and some of the suggestions that we had originally thought didn't take into account the practicalities of operating an ice arena. So we made lots of changes. And usually when the rule comes out, there are myriad changes that have been made. They might be minor adjustments, or some of them are major. But yes, the public influences the process frequently and constantly.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you very much. I just have a follow-up question. With the expedited rulemaking process, where the public doesn't have as much input, have you found that has worked pretty well when the legislature has granted permission for expedited rulemaking, or is there still some feedback from the public saying, wait a minute, we need to slow down on this a little bit?
Ms. Wingett.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, there are people that will be talking about the expedited rule process after I do. The one time that I have been involved extensively with expedited rules, we did work very hard to engage the public. We didn't have a hearing. If an expedited rule doesn't work, people will complain. They'll complain back to the legislature. They'll complain to the agency. They will make their wishes known, and we'll hear that the rule doesn't work. But the expedited process, you're right, it doesn't require that the agency have a hearing. It doesn't require that the agency adopt any comments that are made to it. There's just a 30-day comment period. That's right.
And Ms. Wingett, it's my understanding that the legislature, if we hear from our public that something's wrong with the rule, that we can always write legislation, and that trumps the rulemaking process if we change it with legislation that we pass?
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct. The legislature has complete authority to to rule through, I mean, to act, to govern through legislation. Yes, it can repeal rules through legislation. The agencies cannot act without legislative authority.
Thank you, Ms. Winget. Representative Kahn.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I don't know if Ms. Winget is the proper person to do this. I think, I don't know if you ever have staff comment on historical perspectives, but I think Mr. Geldman was the world's authority on this. And there were two things that we had in place, and I think we no longer have in place. I know one we no longer. One, we had a legislative committee on rules and administrative procedures that had the ability to listen to a complaint about a rule and maybe even repeal that rule, some authority to repeal it or change it. And also, Mr. Geldman chaired a terrific commission, of which, of course, I can't exactly, it was something like Commission on Efficiency in Government or something like that. And I think they had the ability, they also had the ability to repeal rules without a legislative process, although it may have had to come back to the legislature for approval. And I've been running into some really difficult rules to deal with, mainly with, as chair of the Legacy Committee, mainly with legacy appropriations and the state arts board and things like that, and told, you know, that, well, that's a rule and you can't, you just have to do it. And it just seems to me some ability to adjust things that aren't, that people feel aren't working well without total legislative repeal would be a good idea. I don't know if anyone's going to talk about that later in the process, but
I don't know. We'll see. But that's something that part of another part of the process that we're looking at here with the governor's announcement of his unsession, and maybe the testifiers as they come forward can think about that and bring it forward. That maybe there are things that we can do to make the process simpler, quicker, more open. As things we could look at and consider in the next session.
Okay, is part of an unsession then putting back something in place that we, so undoing something that we did in the past that made life much more difficult for a lot of people? Is that considered an un?
If it's
double negative, is that the grammarian's?
I would think that if it's, we're trying to make government more efficient, putting something back in that had done that in the past, or some people perceived to have done that in the past, might or might not be something that the governor will look on. I can't read his mind.
Well, I just wanted a grammatical construction of double negatives. Do they work?
Any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Winget. The next person here is the Honorable Eric Lipman. Welcome back to the House.
Thank you kindly, members, Mr. Chairman, Chairwoman Pappas. My name is Eric Lipman. I'm an administrative law judge with the Minnesota Office of Administrative Hearings. I want to thank the members of both committees, both the House members and senators, for taking time out of their schedules during the interim to undertake this important inquiry. It really is colossally important. I'll come back to that theme later, but I know that you all have very busy schedules. I promise you, though, if you do pay attention to some of the information that's shared with you today, you will get back in session each and every minute that you spend here, probably many more so, because when stakeholders will come to you and make rulemaking-related requests. After today, you will be so much more knowledgeable about the processes and the intricacies that it will be a value add. And so I'm so grateful that you took on faith the invitation that the committee chairs sent to you to come and spend time here. I pledge to you that it will be worthwhile. Today I'm going to be working off of two handouts, sort of low-tech, it's just photocopies. One, how Representative Lipman fell in love with the state of need and reasonableness, how I fell in love with the sonar when I was a member of the House Committee on Government Operations. I'm glad to tell you that love story. And the second is a second late-breaking handout, a chart that's like this, where I tried to map out, because, again, I tend to see things along a line, along a continuum. This will be Lipman's continuum of agency discretion. When members are struggling with trying to figure out the various different kinds of rulemaking procedures there are, I thought it was helpful to have a little map. And I think that the various types of procedures can be mapped along a line of agency continuum, sometimes where there's less procedure and we give the agency more discretion, and then other occasions where there's more procedural hoops and we give agencies less discretion. Okay? And part of the key function that both of these committees play in the legislature and in the rulemaking process is deciding where a particular set of rulemaking requirements are along that continuum. The rest of the members of the House and Senate that are not here with us today, that do not have the good fortune to serve on these committees, they look to you to help decide where on the rulemaking continuum, if you will, that a particular requirement for a state agency to adopt rules should be. And so I'll talk about that in a little bit later. Let me, if I can, just start with the first page of the My Love Story handout and start at the very beginning. And there is an important beginning. If you go to the very first section of Chapter 14, the Minnesota Administrative Procedure Act, it will tell you what the legislature has hoped and has hoped for several decades, that the end product of our rulemaking process, complex although it is, it admittedly is, very complex, but what we're actually trying to achieve with all of this complexity. Okay? And while the actual text of 14.001, the very first words in the Act, are on the left side, I've shortened it up a little bit to get right at the key goals. Their oversight, their accountability, their uniformity, their access and participation by the public, fairness, clarity, and a balanced approach. And those are very tall orders, but I would suggest to you that in the main, even though it is a very complicated, oftentimes expensive procedure, that we do have very good oversight and accountability, that we have tremendous access and participation by the public. It is a fair system. It is a balanced system that treats people courteously and fairly, and I would suggest gets very, very solid results. If you look at the very last paragraph on that particular page, it explains what the legislature that enacted the APA had in mind. Its impact, it says, of the Act, is limited to procedural rights. Okay, we don't give any substantive guarantees. Nobody is entitled to anything in particular because of what's in Chapter 14. They're procedural rights, with the expectation that better substantive results will be achieved in the everyday conduct of state government by, and this is how, here's the real rub, by improving the process by which those items, those results, are attained. It is by having this complex procedure that we hope we'll get an actual better result. And I will try to make the argument as a devil's advocate on behalf of red tape that, in fact, it's not red tape for red tape's sake, that we actually do and can say that we get better substantive results at the end of this admittedly very complicated process. But if people hang with us, both members and stakeholders who participate in the rulemaking process, I think we can give them a better reason to believe in the outcome of those rules. We can inspire greater confidence, and we can cut costs, and we can show, because I think it's a theme that runs throughout Chapter 14, that all of these procedures go to relying upon the wisdom of the group. If the legislature in a small area is going to delegate actual lawmaking power, and that's what happens when you delegate rulemaking, you're delegating lawmaking power to an executive branch official who more than likely doesn't stand for election, you know, a commissioner, an agency board, that kind of thing. The conditions that come with the transfer of that lawmaking power is that it will be done according to a series of procedures as set out by the legislature. That's why the legislature can trust that this is going to be done correctly. This is why the public can trust and have confidence in the results. And they're all geared towards this oversight and access and participation and improvement of results. Okay, so it's a tall order, but that's in fact the goal of what we're trying to achieve when we make these delegations from the legislature to the state agencies. Let me tell you my love story. Under the second page, House File 1537, and you can tell from the there, it was in 2001. I had just recently arrived off the campaign trail, a newly minted member of the Government Operations Committee. And because I had been a rural writer when I had worked for state agencies before being elected by my neighbors in Washington County, they said, okay, well, you'll get the omnibus technical rulemaking bill. Okay, and so like all bright-eyed freshmen, I was going to go out and conquer the world and do great things. I had knocked on 25,000 doors for a reason, and I had come to town, and I was going to do great things. I was going to solve that horrible rulemaking problem. And I hear exactly the same kind of complaints that members hear now. Oh, rulemaking, it's expensive, it's complicated, it's this rigorous, horrible process. And so, as like a dutiful member, I thought, well, where are the difficulties for you? Oh, and as Ms. Winget described in this process, it's in the sonar, okay? Having to go through and make out that statement of need and reasonableness, huge amounts of staff time are dedicated to explaining ourselves and justifying these rules. Great, I'll repeal it. I'll take it out of the statute. You won't have to show your work anymore. Now, thankfully, when that amendment started circling around, I was going to put it on to my omnibus bill here that I was dutifully carrying, House File 1537. I was going to offer this in committee. There were people, some of whom were actually in this room, came to talk with Representative Libman. This is a colossally, profoundly bad idea. And thankfully, they talked me in from the ledge. They showed me what I'm going to show you, which is the very next page. If you go to the statute, 14.131, it details a series of important things that have to be addressed by the state agencies when they're exercising these important lawmaking powers. They're sophisticated and detailed cost-benefit analyses. These things are really important. So it's like my 9-year-old. I want him to show his math homework and how he actually got to the result. I know that it may well be 76 is the answer, but how did you get to 76? The statement of need and reasonableness is how agencies, in fact, show to a rightfully skeptical public, maybe even a rightfully skeptical legislature, that there is an affirmative presentation of facts in support of each of their choices. Okay, that's what the requirement is in Chapter 14, that agencies show by an affirmative presentation of facts. You don't have to take our word for it. You have to actually prove it up, that this choice is one that a rational person could make. And I think one of the wisdom and the great features of our system is that it has an independent review, somebody from our office at OAH, a judge whose paycheck and work conditions do not rely upon a ruling for or against a particular agency. And we can tell the public, you know, I will still have a job to go to if I rule against them or if I rule for them. It doesn't matter. I'm going to critically and deeply assess whether they have the authority to adopt this rule, whether they followed all the procedural requirements, and lastly, that they have shown by this affirmative presentation of facts that a rational person could pick this rule. We don't just have to take their word for them. It's not arbitrary. It's not whimsical. They've actually proven it up with evidence. And those, I think, are important kinds of features. And where we get that evidence, oftentimes, and at least at the starting point, is in the statement of need and reasonableness. These detailed analyses that the legislature requires of state agencies, and it is a lot of work and it's expensive, but it shows in the writing, the agencies, if something doesn't write well or if their evidence isn't there, that will become clear in having to show their work. The other thing at the bottom of page 4 that I think is important, this is a provision that has been frequently, and indeed recently as 2012, been updated by the legislature. The legislature finds these requirements really very useful, and to have agencies show their work. This is a value add, and it's been a value add in each and every decade since this became a part of the statutes. And so, again, I think it's a useful set of requirements. I'm so grateful each and every day that those folks saved me from embarrassment, even though I'm going to tell you my love story here, that I didn't, in fact, offer that amendment to repeal the sonar because it is such an important key piece. Again, going on to my tale of two courthouses, I have a story within a story. How do I know that these kinds of processes, which, again, agencies who don't like the expense and who don't like the length of time that it can well take in developing rules, what is our reply to them? A couple of things. One is, and I'll just take the fiscal year 13 experience, is out of these very complicated subjects, through a detailed legal review undertaken by OAH judges, in 1 out of 5 cases, we found a significant legal problem, a legal defect. Nobody's perfect, but there was some procedural error in one of the rules that was proposed, and in 20% of the cases last year, we found something that the agency needed to remedy. Okay, these were things that didn't go online. They weren't put into the state register. They weren't officially promulgated. They didn't become law because the agency fixed them as a result of this iterative process. I think that that's a useful thing. How do we know at the bottom line where that comes out? I did a Westlaw search, and since January 1st of 2000, there have been 3 reported rulemaking cases. Pat Winchett and others said it's quite rare. She's absolutely right. I found 3, okay, in the last 13 years, since the turn of the century. If you go to the federal courts, and admittedly, the federal sovereign, they have a wider jurisdiction, but there are 3 a week, nearly 1,800 cases in that same time period, because they don't have a detailed sonar process like we do. It's just raw notice and comment, and they certainly don't have any kind of federal OAH. The OIRA, the branch within the Office of Management and Budget, is supposed to do this thing, but it's not any kind of searching or independent review like we have. And I don't think it has the kind of public confidence, and so people sue them. Now, again, for the folks who say, well, the federal government's just so much larger, they have so many more rules, I divided it by 50. So even if you're assuming that Minnesota's share of these cases would be roughly 1/50th, that we're no bigger than Idaho or Rhode Island or Nebraska, none of which I think is true. I think we'd actually be a larger share of the total. But even if you could just say 50, it's still 10 times the experience of litigation in the federal system than we have here in Minnesota. So my message to the legislature is we have a good system. My message to agency rule writers who come and complain, please don't make me go through ordinary rulemaking. It's such a complicated and expensive process. That time that you spend writing the sonar and showing your work is better and more useful than being in a deposition. And I think that there would be litigation where there isn't the same kind of public confidence, there isn't the same kind of input, there isn't the same kind of iterative dialogue that Pat Winchett talked about between agency folks and interested stakeholders. And there is a genuine dialogue. Representative Drukowski, both you and actually Representative Pepin asked earlier before, where are the occasions for public input? Not only is it that green line that she showed you all throughout the process, and certainly if there's an OAH hearing, vigorous public comment, but I would suggest to you that under 14.09, even after the process, interested stakeholders, even today, can petition an agency for rulemaking. So that dialogue continues. Even if you don't persuade them, you can go back a week later and say, we'd like you to start over, we'd like you to do something different. We have a better way to build this mousetrap. The conversation never ends and never should end, because we all rely upon the wisdom of the group. And I think Chapter 14 focuses us on accessing the wisdom of the group. We have no monopolies on wisdom, and we're trying to leverage everyone's expertise. My last thing that I wanted to leave you with is that the legislature has given you a really very important charter. So again, I want you to have my thanks for coming and taking some time to genuinely study what is a complicated area. But the legislature has given you this charter by requiring that any rulemaking that is in any of the bills that are being considered by the legislature first be routed to the respective committees here, both in the House, there's a House version of this rule, and likewise I've quoted the Senate rules. They cannot go to the House or Senate floor without passing by you. And that's for a good reason, because the legislature wants someone to be mindful of the careful calibration having to do with rulemaking authority. And so when you see you're getting a lot of requests, this is why. It is baked into the cake, and they've given you a special charter because, as I've talked informally with other members, I'm not looking at that piece, that rulemaking piece. I'm relying upon GovOps. I'm relying upon the State Gov Committee to sort that out and to focus on that. And I hope, as a former member of the Government Operations Committee, a former member, and someone now who works in this field, that you'll enjoy that charge, that you'll ask for help if you feel you need it, or we can be a teaching resource for you, because your constituents and your colleagues look to you to be the subject matter experts, to be the important gatekeepers. And as you're the gatekeepers, I wanted to try and give you this chart and leave you with it. And I hope the citations were correct. This was what I thought of at breakfast this morning, which is of all the various choices, and there are lots of different choices, I think that they can be put upon a continuum of more discretion for the agency or less discretion for the agency. Okay? And so it may well be that a member of an agency says, in this particular bill, because of the program that we want to get up and running today, please don't make us go through ordinary rulemaking. And I think with a chart like this, you can have a dialogue. Well, what's really the issue? Is it that you're concerned about a hearing and you won't be able to get up and running? Or is this something perhaps where we could give you a break for 2 years, maybe the exempt two-year option, but then you would go back and do the ordinary rulemaking so we can build the public confidence? A chart like this will allow you to sort of maybe discuss and trade. And this is certainly what happens, I think, more with senior members of this committee, because they would know these types of things already. But I want every member to be involved in this kind of careful calibration. And so I tried to chart out for myself between the twin poles of allowing the agencies doing pretty much what they wish without much detail or facing the public, which is certainly the true in the federal system. The federal system would be very much near the W on this continuum. Or by having very special detailed procedures which aren't given to regular rules. I think the immunization rules, I recently had that case. It was recently a Department of Health case. There were ordinary rulemaking rules plus. We wanted you to contact special stakeholders. We wanted you to go through certain procedures that we didn't apply to everybody else because we're specially concerned about this area. And as the legislature and as controlling the delegation, you have the entire swath of that continuum to make whatever judgment you see fit. So this committee is given a special charge to be experts. I encourage you to use every color on the palette because your constituents will benefit from it, and we will benefit from your thoughtful discernment. And so with that, you have my very grateful thanks for giving me time, and I'm grateful to answer any questions that members may well have.
Representative Cohen.
Well, one of the I know, because I used to chair this committee, and we used to, and my staff people were particularly alert for looking for the bills that did rules that people had tried to send directly to the floor and so forth. But one of the things that's happened, as I've seen on other committees, and I started to try and use my iPad to find it, is that using Synonym Finder to find synonyms for rules is that people use all kinds of other words that are not rules. You know, advice, consideration. If I'd gone a little faster, if I could do this a little faster, I probably could have given you a whole list of them. But how are we dealing with this? There are a lot of things which end up acting like a rule, but haven't been called a rule, so they may avoid the expert eyes of both of you. How is that being dealt with?
Mr. Chairman?
Judge Lichtman.
Mr. Chairman, the Senator, and Representative Kahn, I think the motion to re-refer is the best and most powerful tool.
Well,
and Representative Kahn, I know myself and my CA, Mr. Geldman, we this last year were watching and looking at the bills as they were being introduced and as they worked through the process to make sure. I mean, that's why I think we had 180 plus bills referred to our committee this last year and heard close to 120 bills because of the number of rulemaking pieces that were in different bills, and hopefully we didn't miss any, but we tried. And I can't speak for the Senate. I don't know. I'm assuming that they have the same type of diligence of looking for that stuff.
Mr. Chairman, what was nice about that was that you didn't need to make the motion to re-refer. I mean, because it was a rule of the House. Mm-hmm. You just had to point it out to the presiding officer, and then it just happened. But the problem of the using of other words, and I just want to know, have both of you dealt with that, or have you seen it, or what's happened?
Senator Pappas? Chair Pappas?
Well, I'm just thinking about what other words people might use. I mean, sometimes I think that authors do try to, in a sense, put the rules in the statute to avoid rulemaking. So I'd have to see an example. I don't know if there's been cases where, because maybe it didn't get referred to our committee.
And Representative Kahn, I know the last, there were some bills, there were some that we saw that people were more creative with setting up agencies and setting up reviews and those things that also have to come to us more so than the rules. But we tried to, at least I tried to make sure that the other chairs and other people on the, on our committee, that if you saw a bill that we hadn't heard that had rulemaking in it, that you made sure it got referred to us in the, the Government Operations Committee. And I believe Representative Pappin, when she chaired this committee, did the same thing.
Mr. Chairman, I think the question was, it's clear if it says rulemaking or it says exempt from rulemaking, it's clear it comes to our committees. It's when, I think Representative Kahn's talking about when other words are used, and I can't think of an example of that.
Okay. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lippman, who has authority to make rules or to make final decision-making? What kind of bodies can do that?
Judge Lippman.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, they all follow from specific delegations of rulemaking authority that are in statutes. They start out in bills or in chapter laws, and it's a direction to an executive branch agency or a board to adopt rules in particular areas. And one of the functions that I do as part of the legal review is to make sure that the body trying to promulgate rules does in fact have the legal authority to do so. And sometimes among the defects that we do find is that the agency has bitten off more than it has been legally delegated to chew.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lippman, so if a council of citizens were created by the legislature and the legislature gave that council authority to decide whether a set of trails could be constructed across a certain piece of property owned by the state. Would that be fall in the category of rulemaking? And would that be the type of council that could make such a decision?
Judge Lippman.
Could well be. I don't mean to hedge my bets, but let me try to show you my reasoning, Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler. A rule under 14.02, subdivision 4, is every statement of general applicability and future effect adopted to implement or make specific the law enforced or administered by that agency or to govern its organization and procedure. So 14.02, subdivision 4. And so I think that how I usually take that phrase is, does it impact public rights? And I think that if the legislature created this council and invested with authority and indeed oftentimes, you know, directed it to make rules for that would impact public rights. You know, somebody else has an interest in that trail or use of that trail or access to that trail, that may well be a rulemaking.
Representative Ryan.
And Mr. Chair,
close. Yeah.
Mr. Lippman, so if the delegation was interpreted that way, they would normally need to follow the full rulemaking process without, unless there was some specific exemption.
Sure. And Mr. Chairman and Representative Winkler, I think it's 14.386. No, I'm sorry. 14.381. If an agency does do something that looks like a duck and quacks like a duck and sounds like a duck, if it looks like a rule and acts like a rule and has that statement of general applicability and future effect and doesn't go through the ordinary processes, citizens under 14.381 can file a petition with our office and get what is amounts to a declaratory judgment of sorts. I will investigate, or whoever has assigned the case will investigate the case. This agency has adopted what is in fact a rule but hasn't gone through the ordinary procedural protections, and they are not allowed to enforce that particular regulation, and we do have case law on this, where the department is not to not permitted to enforce a circular. That's what frequently happens. You know, this is regulatory guidance, and there isn't a specific statutory exemption for that, but everybody knows that it operates like a rule. If they haven't gone through a rulemaking, citizens can come to our office and get some relief from that particular requirement, and it has happened.
Representative Winkley.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, this specific example that I've tried to generalize here is the Lessard-Sams Council. In the 2011 legacy bill, it was for the property in the Brainerd area that was and the state purchased. And the 2011 legacy bill gave the Lessard-Sams Council the right to approve any trail that would be built across that property. And Mr. Lippman, the Lessard-Sams Council is a legislative council. It's not in the executive branch. It's in the legislative branch. Mm-hmm. And yet, by the language of that bill, and I think this is still on the books today, no trail could be built across that property, but except with the permission of the Lessard-Sams Council, which doesn't have any ownership of the property. So, in effect, that is it sounds to me, from your definition, that would be like a rulemaking type decision.
Could well be, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Judge Lippman. We were provided by House Research, Mark Shepard, with a list of various pieces of legislation that were authorized under good cause exemptions, all the different types of exemptions you have listed on your list. And as the chair has mentioned, that we did hear quite a few of these during the legislative session, and one of the frustrations that I have with that process is that, unfortunately, because of time, and this is no disrespect to the committee chair, because I understand the time restraints, but we're not able to kind of delve into anything other than the paragraph about rulemaking, and when you don't have the perspective of the entire piece of legislation and the ability to kind of to delve into that further, you kind of get the sense that this committee kind of just becomes a rubber stamp on the rulemaking authority, and I'm wondering, which causes me some concern about if we should do things differently. But I'm wondering if you could maybe just kind of generally comment from your perspective, being in the legislature, being in this committee, and now being where you're at, has this this kind of need for good cause exemptions? I know the language says for good cause exemptions that there would have to be an immediate threat to public health, safety, or welfare for this to kick in, but yet I see a number of them here that I don't believe is an immediate threat to public safety or welfare, and I'm wondering if, in your view, this has been more commonplace in the last few years, or has it always been this kind of loose with when we're going to use this expedited process and kind of cut the public out a little bit?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, I guess part of my former member's tale is that the same things that you are hearing today have at least in my experience, been so. They were certainly true in 2001 and 2000 through 2004 when I served as a member of this committee, and so that they are very familiar refrains. Among the things that I think are good options to talk about, which is if there is, Tom Cruise might say, I have a need for speed, if there is a need to get to rulemaking or set of rules and things which determine public rights quickly, and having been as an agency manager and actually made those pitches in certain contexts on behalf of the Secretary of State's office to this body, to have an accelerated process. And I think there are legitimate reasons to do so. Exploring those two-year options where we will do this in a summary fashion now because we need the program to be up and running quickly, but you will go back and undertake ordinary rulemaking. And I think that those are perhaps underutilized options. And what I wanted to try and do with this map is I think that you can do all sorts of creativity. And indeed, if you look at the easternmost, that's a reminder that you can put on any kind of conditions that you want. It's your delegation, and in talking about this amongst yourselves or as caucuses or as committee members, I think that you can scale the kinds of conditions on the exercise of rulemaking authority and mix and match as you best see fit. Whether as a body, and I know the committee time is at a premium, it always is, that makes the most sense, but I found that those conversations are... are better and more useful if they occur as part of the agenda-setting discussion. What's going to be on the committee's agenda? Well, you get a hearing if, you know, we have some flexibility. You know, we're kind of concerned about, you know, how broad this delegation of rulemaking is, or if, you know, ranking members and chairs can kind of come to some understandings. You know, in this context, it's okay. In that context, we're more concerned about it as a way of dividing up a time. And I'm hopeful that as people think about this in interim and have charts like this, that they can have more detailed and useful conversations about how to set those agendas and not be so cramped for time. So again, I want to thank you, Representative Pepin, and the chairs for making this time, because I think it's so useful to think about these things in interim when there isn't that crush, so that you can use your time effectively and well once you get back into session. Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair and Judge Lipman, I appreciate that, and I do really appreciate this chart. I think it gives us a lot more things to consider, and I would suggest that we even have this next session when we come back here, because this would be a good chart to have whenever we have to make decisions on rulemaking. Just overall, though, I'm wondering, based on your history, do you think that we have moved more west on your chart or east on your chart in the last 10 years since you've been involved, in how much, by how much, just generally, as far as are we moving more in the direction of speeding through the good cause exemptions, expedited rulemaking process, or have we gotten more strict?
Judge Lipman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, I'm going to take an uneducated guess. I'm going to take an uneducated guess, but just my gut reaction, and it would be an interesting thing to go back and study. My sense is that some people who are better at legislative relations and government relations are more frequent travelers west, or able to go west, and some are not. It's not equally distributed. And there may well be good reasons for that. But I think my sense is the more west you go, the better you are, the better, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't put the benchmark for agency liaisons in this room, that, you know, that their real red badge of courage is if they get an exemption or not. But my sense is that the folks who are better at it get the exemption. Maybe that's a little too cheeky. I don't mean to be. But I think in the main, most agencies are going through ordinary rulemaking. It is a process, while is complicated and difficult. Even OAH goes through this process. We have a, you know, request for comments out. We are subject to the very same rules, and we point to with pride, frankly, that we are relying upon the wisdom of the group as we set our own rules of procedures in this way. It is a complicated, perhaps sometimes expensive system, but just like insurance, you don't like cutting that check to State Farm. You are glad when the tornado hits that you made these kinds of investments, and it is money well spent.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Lipman, how would an agency that's not subject to Chapter 14 go about the rulemaking process?
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, I think the best example, probably, if you go to my excluded box there, is the Department of Corrections. They are generally exempt from rulemaking because you wouldn't want petitioners writing in and asking for a hearing. That could be a very long hearing indeed if you had all the folks of prison rules subject to prisoners writing in. And so there's a very broad exemption. There's only one limited exemption where they have to regulate their halfway houses and through the ordinary rulemaking process. And I know that because they don't do it all that often, that it's a challenge for agency staff people to sort of think in this new way because they have such a broad exemption. But I think in recent years they've done yeoman's work in learning this new language. And even folks who don't do it all the time, I guess is my answer to the question, find it helpful and benefit from it.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Judge Lipman, so do they, in that case, does the agency just basically write the rules, or they've got an internal process? Obviously, they're not subject to Chapter 14, so they don't have to go through these other processes.
Sure.
It's Judge Lipman.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, if I understand the question, so when they undertake rulemaking, how do they do it? Okay. And so I think in the Department of Corrections example, one of the things that they did, and I commend members who want to encourage staff to go next week, is the annual rulemaking seminar. Our seminar is 18 years old. Many of the people that are here today will also be presenting. We do an all-day training session, great CLE credit for the lawyers who would like to get a little extra CLEs, and a wonderful the best convention all year. And so the agency people will go and send themselves to this for this 5 or 6 hour training. There is a manual, a 400-page manual with all the forms and to-dos and checklists and materials that people use. And so we have reduced it. Actually, Pat Winget is a key author and maintainer of that. Dave Horan, who's here, was an early architect of this. They have boiled it down into easy cookbook-style recipes of how to go through each of these processes so people don't make mistakes that later become problematic. And that was certainly what the Department of Corrections did, and their work is great. Representative Skowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question, Judge Lipman. So does the OAH have jurisdiction in these cases where agencies are not covered by Chapter 14?
Judge Lipman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dostkowski, if there is an exemption in favor of Agency X and they don't have to follow Chapter 14, they don't have to visit me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? If not?
You have my very grateful thanks, members. Thank you.
And now Mr. Paul Merrimack. Merrimack.
I'm Chair, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Merrimack. I'm the Deputy Reviser for Drafting. And I'd like to speak to you a few minutes about rulemaking exemptions. I understand that at least one of the reasons for the meeting today was the concern over rulemaking exemptions. So I thought I'd spend a few minutes talking about work that the legislature has done in the past that really led up to the adoption of the good cause exemption and the general scheme for rulemaking exemptions. For 13 years, I was also counsel to the LCRER, the Legislative Commission to Review Administrative Rules. I only mention that because some of the activity that I'm going to be talking about was action taken by that commission. I understand that Representative Kahn has some questions about the LCRER, and I'd be happy to answer that, time allows. I really start in 1984. Before 1984, the legislature hadn't conducted a general review of rulemaking exemptions. The difficulty was these exemptions were typically off the grid. The legislature would grant a very broad exemption from rulemaking, giving the department authority to adopt standards or guidelines or rules that are exempt from Chapter 14. Now, that was clear that there was not the Chapter 14 process, but there was no other process that was mandated. So it was very, very difficult. The Legislative Commission to Review Administrative Rules started taking testimony and from the public, who was generally very, very concerned, because the first time they would find out that an exemption existed is when the department sought to enforce it. And so the commission decided to conduct a series of hearings to find out the extent of the problem. The LCRR, as I said, it was concerned about the promulgation and enforcement of the exempt rules because there wasn't any standard process. And I apologize for my PowerPoint. This is a problem, so excuse me. But I'll continue. But there are really six problems that the LCRR was concerned about. With these exemptions, there was no public notice. There was no explanation or justification for the exempt rules. There was no independent review of the agency decisions to adopt the exempt rule. There was no minimum process required. There was no public access. The reviser didn't know about the existence of these rules, so we could not publish them in Minnesota Rules. And finally, the legal status is unclear. It's clear if a rule is adopted pursuant to the APA, it has the force and effect of law and can be enforced in that regard. The first legislative action was taken in 1984. The LCRR asked the legislature to adopt a statute, 14.385, that attempted to smoke out some of these emergency rules, find out what their exempt rules, find out if they existed. So there's a statute passed that said no rule that is exempt from the rulemaking provisions of Chapter 14 has the force and effect of law after January 1, 1985, unless prior to that time it's been filed with the reviser of statutes and published in Minnesota Rules. So this was the first attempt to try to get a handle on it. It was moderately successful. I think we received fewer than a dozen rules that were filed pursuant to this. But the important point is the other rules that weren't filed no longer had the force and effect of law and could not be enforced by the agency. One of the two handouts I've given you are the report from the LCRER subcommittee on exemptions. Again, all throughout these years, the LCRER was continuing to look at the subject of rulemaking exemptions. The report is interesting in at least two respects. It discusses the need for legislative rules to examine rulemaking exemptions. The LCRER felt very strongly that there should be House and Senate permanent rules that require exemptions to be referred to government operations committees so that there could be a consistency of review. What had been happening in the past is rulemaking exemptions would come in at any stage in the process. They would be in the introduced bill, it would be offered in committee, they'd be offered on the floor of the House and Senate, and they'd be offered in conference committee. And so to attempt to achieve sort of a consistency of review, those legislative rules were enacted. The LCRER also recommended a process to be followed by certain exempt rules. Now, we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail. And we used the Model State Administrative Procedure Act as a guide. Let me say a bit about the Model Administrative Procedure Act. Uniform Laws Commission recommends many uniform acts to the legislature, and you may have been dealing with them in the past several years. These uniform acts are proposed in areas where uniformity among the states is extremely important. They also propose model acts. And model acts, the goal is a different goal. It's frozen. The goal is a different goal. It's reform. And so in this area, the Uniform Laws Commission has proposed Model Administrative Procedures Act since 1946. There are acts in 1946, 61, 81, and 2010. Minnesota has borrowed heavily from these model acts. And in fact, with regard to the good cause exemption that we've been talking about, the LCRER recommended that the legislature look at that as the model for rulemaking exemptions. The next action is taken in 1993. You have what is referred to as a Chapter 370 report. The legislature directed the LCRER to submit a report to the House and Senate Government and Operations Committees on a number of rule-related topics, including rulemaking exemptions. You'll find the recommendations in the report in your packet, but let me just summarize them briefly. The LCRER recommended the repeal of the Emergency Rulemaking Authority, and I won't go into a detailed explanation, but that was another expedited process for the agency to adopt rules without the full-blown rulemaking. It recommended the adoption of a good cause exemption, as we talked about before. And it even suggested a standard to be used by the Government Operations Committee in reviewing exemptions. Those recommendations and many others were contained in really the last major administrative APA bill in 1995. Chapter 233, among other things, it repealed the emergency rulemaking process. It established a general procedure for the adoption of exempt rules, and it established a good cause exemption. Let me look at those in a little bit more detail. This builds on really the excellent written descriptions that Mr. Shepard from House Research has provided in your packet, and I'd really suggest if you're interested in that to read those also. The legislature adopted a general exempt rule procedure. Again, it's in 14.386. And it says, any rule adopted or amended or repealed by an agency but excluded from the rulemaking provisions or from the definition of a rule has the force and effect of law only if a number of things occur. The reviser in the Office of Administrative Hearings approve the rules, the agency signs an order adopting the rule, and the rule is published in the State Register. So again, we see these concerns that the LCRER initially had with exempt rules are being addressed in the process now. Public notice, public access, independent review, adequate justification, minimum process, and a clear legal status. In addition, the legislature in 95 again tried to clean the slate. They adopted Minnesota Statutes 14.387, which basically said any rule in existence at the time of the law was enacted that did not go through the general rulemaking authorities was of no force and effect, and the statutory authority that was granted to do the rules expired. Again, it was the idea was to clean the slate, to get rid of this body of exempt rulemaking, to get ready for the implementation of these new procedures. Finally, the 95 legislation enacted the good cause exemption from the Model Act. And the good cause exemption provides that an agency may not adopt, amend, or repeal a rule, or an agency may adopt, amend, or repeal a rule if for good cause finds that the rulemaking provisions of the chapter are unnecessary, impractical, and contrary to the public interest. That was the Model Act standard. But Minnesota went farther. They tightened this up. And in addition, they could only do it to address a serious and immediate threat to the health, safety, or welfare, to comply with a court order or requirement in federal law in a manner that doesn't allow for compliance with the normal rulemaking provisions. That was a standard in the emergency rulemaking authority that was lifted and put here when the emergency rulemaking authority was repealed. And then clauses 3 and 4 were technical and housekeeping in nature, allowed the agency to use the good cause exemption to incorporate specific changes in the rules so that they mirrored the statute and there was no interpretation involved. And they also allowed agencies to make changes that don't alter the sense, meaning, or effect of the rule. This is a very expeditious way for the agency to make technical changes to make sure that their rules are up to date and current. Again, you'll see the central concerns of the LCRER in the good cause exemption. The reviser in the Office of Administrative Hearings must approve the rule. The rule must be adopted in the state register. And then the substantive provisions in clause 1 and 2 are effective for, we have this. Bear with me here. The clause 1 and 2 rules are effective for 2 years. Those are the substantive provisions. The idea was after 2 years, the agency would need to go back to the legislature for a reauthorization of the exemption or the authority to adopt a permanent rule. And the clause in 3 and 4, which were the technical changes, were permanent. The final legislative action that was taken with regard to exempt rules occurred in 1997. This was a year after the LCRER was eliminated. And I bring this up because it's a really wonderful example of a very, very thorough review of the entire field of exemptions by the legislature. This legislation implemented recommendations that were made after a very thorough review of all of the statutory exemption language in the statutes. You see, the bullet points that I have here are really summaries of the different articles in the bill. There's a whole article dealing with exemptions that were eliminated or were no longer needed or for which rulemaking was required. There was a category of exemptions that were eliminated because they were covered under generic exemptions. These were really drafting issues. There didn't need to be specific exemptions. There were exemptions eliminated because the exemptions were not rules in the first place. They shouldn't have been written as exemptions. And finally, there were a category of exemptions that were retained but significantly amended. In addition, the 1997 legislation established the expedited rules process that we're dealing with today. Again, Mr. Shepard's memo goes through this in great detail. Let me emphasize just a couple points. This is not a standing grant of authority. The legislature needs to authorize the use of the expedited rules process. Again, you see the proposed rule has to be approved by the reviser, published in the state register, a 30-day comment period provided. The Office of Administrative Hearings must approve the rule. The adopted rule must be published in the state register. And there's a public hearing requirement. If the legislature directs that a public hearing option is in play, then if 100 or more persons request a hearing, then the agency must vote a hearing on the rule. Again, you can see the concerns of the LCRER were reflected in here, public access, public notice, minimum process, independent legal review, justification. In addition, what the agency gains from this is no request for comment needs to be published. You found the importance of the sonar. was discussed thoroughly today. No sonar is prepared on expedited rules. And the public trigger is raised. What I mean by that is in normal rulemaking proceedings, if an agency attempts to go to permanent rulemaking without a hearing, they can be asked to go to public hearing by 25 or more persons. That threshold in the expedited rules is raised to 100. Let me conclude my remarks if the technology will allow. I'd like to talk about a couple resources that the Revisor's Office has developed for use by the public and the legislature. And the first thing that I'm going to show you is 25 years in the making, and it was really a response to the concerns that the LCRER had from the public. The public wanted to know, how do we get access to important rulemaking information? How do we get access to the sonars? How do we get access to the notices? How do we know that an agency is proposing something? So in response to this, the Revisor's Office started building a website that would have this information for the public. It's taken 25 years for us to finally realize this. And I won't go into the details of the story other than to say it involves the usual suspects, budgetary constraints, technological limitations, and really poor timing. But we're glad to say that as of last May, we have published online a website that will allow the public and legislators and legislative staff to get certain information about legislative rules. And if I could take a moment of your time just to... And of course, this is frozen too. There we go. From the Revisor's website that displays all of the law, you'll notice the two links that say new here. The first thing that we did is we realized that the first 20 years of the State Register had not been digitized and available to the public. They were still in paper form. So we took the first 20 years, digitized it, made it into searchable PDFs, and offered the entire series of the State Register on our website in searchable PDF form. We also linked up to the status system so the public would have access to all of these important public notices that we've talked about today. There we go. The system itself, you'll notice that the interface that we use is familiar to most of us. It's the same interface that we use for the bill status systems for the House and Senate. And that's not surprising. The Revisor's Office develops the software and the hardware and designs the bill status systems for the House and Senate. So it was very easy for us to use the same interface for here. Through this interface, you can see you can search for on a number of things related to administrative rulemaking by agency, term searches, by the type of action. We have been talking about exemptions, expedited rules today. You can access the body that we have of information dating back to the 1980s here. So it's a very robust system. What we intend to do, obviously, is to see if there's any interest on the part of legislative staff to get some training with regard to this and perhaps help you do your jobs. In addition, I'd like to show you one other thing. You see at the top, this was put together just for demonstration purposes today. And it's a narrower type of website that's designed, we think, to help you help the committees do their jobs. I made certain assumptions here. I may be totally incorrect. But what we did is it's referred to as the Senate Administrative Rule Status System. The reason we chose the Senate for demonstration purposes is on each Senate committee website, they have a list of the agencies under the jurisdiction of that committee. So we could use that information to build the system. But this is what the system would allow you to do. Let's assume, and you'll notice here, you can choose your own time period to search, including custom. But let's say for the last 2 years, we want to find what the state and local government committee, all of the adopted rules for jurisdictions under the committee, of agencies under that committee. And if it will cooperate, we'll see that there are eight. So eight rules have been adopted. And then this links to the system itself. So, for example, let's look at the Minnesota Racing Commission Breeders' Fund. This is a good example because this shows you all of the information that's now available in the public rule status system. This is not access to the complete rulemaking record. We never intended it to be. But we wanted to preserve the really important documents. You see that there's a link to the sonar here. And you heard about the importance of the sonar this afternoon. This will be preserved permanently in the system. The legal opinion of the Office of Administrative Hearings is here. All of the notices in the State Register, if we can get it to cooperate. It works much better when you don't operate through the board. Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, I think my worst fears have been realized. This is not going to be cooperating. Oh, there it is. There it goes back again. This goes back to the basic search. But what that will allow each committee to do is to look at things under their jurisdiction and get all of the information that we've had here. So I said we have a wealth of historical information here, and going forward we'll be able to pick up the same sorts of information. So if you're concerned about exempt rulemaking, for example, you can query the system to find out what agencies are doing under the jurisdiction of your committee. And again, we'll have some conversations with House and Senate committees to see whether that would be helpful or not. Madam Chair, I think before the whole laptop explodes on me, I think I'll end my comments here. Thank you for letting me show you the system today and talk a little bit about exempt rules. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Any questions for the testifier? Chair Pappas.
Thank you. Mr. Marinak, then, when did the Legislative Commission to Review Administrative Rules then go out of existence? Was it that year?
Madam Chair, it was in 1996. It was operating from 1974 to 1996.
Any further questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Marinak, I have a couple questions. One is on the threshold numbers, the 100 or the 25 persons. And is person defined as a Minnesotan or an adult? Or I'm just thinking now with the internet, and if there's a rulemaking, you could have worldwide request for comment.
Yeah.
Do we have that defined anywhere?
Mr. Marinak.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, if I could yield to Ms. Winget, maybe she could help answer the question. I don't believe that the Administrative Procedure Act defines person.
Welcome back, Ms. Winget.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, thanks. Representative, let me make sure I understand the question. You're asking whether people outside the jurisdiction of Minnesota can come in on our rules?
Or
trigger hearings.
Or hear it. Well, we have looked at that question, and the answer is that the APA does not define person other than, you know, an individual. So there's no restriction on whether those comments or requests come from Minnesotans only. So we have had requests in the rulemakings that I've been involved in that have been people from outside the country and outside the state, and people have, and we've counted them. I don't see that we have any other way to read that statute.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you. So if we had 100 Australians ask for a hearing, we would give them one?
Yes.
Ms. Winget.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes.
Okay.
Representative Hansen.
I can ask a different line of question. It seems, serving on the environment committees, that and even looking in Mr. Shepard's document, we just have a lot of Department of Natural Resources exemptions. I mean, almost every season or change in hunting and fishing, we've got a rulemaking, and then we have an exemption for that. And back when there was the processes set up, did they envision that almost every DNR bill would have a request for an exemption, a good cause exemption? I mean, it just seems like we have a lot of these, and I think we had a number come in front of the committee, and I'd just like your opinion on that, if that was thought of back when the processes were set up.
Ms. Wingett or Mr. Merrimack? Ms. Wingett, whoever wants to answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not prepared to answer that question. We do have a representative from the Department of Natural Resources who will be speaking in just a few minutes.
Mr. Mayor, Representative Hansen, the only thing I can say from the perspective of the LCRER is when the emergency rulemaking procedure was eliminated, it was preserved for the Department of Natural Resources. And so the legislature made a conscious decision to preserve that process. The other expedited emergency rules and those things came after, and I think Ms. Carlson can address that later in her presentation.
Thank you. Any further questions? Testifiers. If not, thank you for your information, and we'll go on to the next section here. We're going to have a panel discussion here, and I don't think if the intent is to have them all come up at once. We have Ms. Beth Schaefer from the Administrative Law Manager, Department of Human Services, Ms. Leggy from the Chief Counsel for Department of Labor and Industry, Ms. Carlson from the Strategic Planning and Policy, and Mr. Affelt from the Administrative Law, Minnesota Bar Administrative Law Section. I don't know if they're all going to come up at once or?
Two by two.
Two by two, okay. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committees, my name is Beth Schaefer, and I'm the Administrative Law Manager at the Department of Human Services. I manage the rulemaking function there. The Department of Human Services has done a lot of rulemaking. We have 29 chapters of rules, and in each of these chapters, there may be up to 6 individual rules, each governing a different topic. What I'm going to do is just very briefly address, first, why DHS typically exceeds, goes beyond, the statutory requirements for any major rulemaking, and then secondly, briefly describe for you how the exempt process has worked very well for us. So now, at DHS, a lot of times when we have any major rulemaking ahead of us, we will plan on going to a public hearing. We will start right out with a notice of hearing. And when there is a public hearing, what the Act requires is the public hearing forum, and then in addition to that, 3 written comment periods. But what we do is we go beyond that. We collaborate and we interact with our stakeholders long before we ever get to the hearing. In fact, we usually do that before we ever propose a published rule. What does that look like? Well, Ms. Wingett had mentioned that we use advisory committees. That's a very common tool for DHS. We like to use advisory committees because then we know that we have all the different viewpoints represented on the committee. We can have diversity geographically. We can have diversity of provider type. We can have diversity ethnically, and we get the various viewpoints. Now, for example, at DHS, a lot of our work is around the medical assistance program. So we'll have various healthcare representatives with expertise in the particular topic area that we're discussing. For example, if we have a mental health rule, we would get mental health professionals. And we would also want advocates for the public health benefits recipients themselves. So we would have somebody from the Disability Law Center, an attorney that would represent those interests. And we also like provider representatives. So we would have individuals from various professional associations there. And then finally, we also like to have an insurance company representative because they perform a function that is analogous to DHS's function in medical assistance. Now, a completely different approach, other than advisory committees, is public forums. And these can take a number of different looks. In a public forum, the context is much larger because we reach out broadly and we invite any member of the public that's interested in the rule. The public forum, it could involve presentations by the members of the agency to explain the rule or to preview the procedures. Oftentimes, we will have the members in the forum break into different discussion groups through which they can provide input. Now, these advisory committees and these public forums add a lot of time to the rulemaking process, and they also take a considerable amount of work. So why do we do this? It's exactly like what Judge Lippman said earlier. It adds value. It's a benefit. There are better results. Our stakeholders have really good ideas. We routinely, commonly, will amend a draft rule in response to comments from our stakeholders. And also, their input helps us to avoid unintended consequences that we didn't think about yet. And then also, when we're discussing issues, either in a public forum or in a committee, we weed out a lot of issues before we ever get to the public hearing. We resolve a lot of the issues by discussing these with our stakeholders. And then the issues that are still left are more fully developed because we've heard opposing points of view and individual proponents of different ideas have heard one another. So the judge gets a more refined position. Now, because of these various benefits, most of the big state agencies all do this. They all do this collaboration and interaction before publishing a proposed rule. Each agency has a little bit different way of doing it depending on their own needs. And in fact, even within DHS, each rulemaking might do it a little bit differently because each rulemaking is unique. But I know that you have been receiving a lot of requests from agencies that would like to circumvent all of the normal rulemaking procedures. But in fact, I just want to paint a picture for you that I would venture to say that many agencies embrace the spirit of rulemaking, which is to exceed the requirements and engage in this interaction beyond what is actually required. Now, exempt rulemaking has worked very well for DHS. With exempt rulemaking, we can omit many of the virtually all of the procedures that are required, but we can only do so in very limited circumstances. The showing that the agency must make for what's called a good cause exemption is that, first, that the normal rulemaking procedures are unnecessary, impracticable, or contrary to the public interest. And in addition, the agency has to show that the criteria are met for one of four different scenarios. And Mr. Shepard's House research sheet that he gave you, this is a one-sheet paper, and it's entitled Short Subjects, Rulemaking, Expedited Process, and Exemptions. If you wanted to refer to that, at the bottom of the first page and continuing on to the next page is a list of those four scenarios that provide the basis for a good cause exemption. The good cause exemption that DHS uses quite frequently is the one that applies when the legislature changes a DHS program through a statute. A good cause exemption can be used when an agency is merely going to incorporate specific statutory changes into a corresponding rule, and no interpretation of law is required to do that. Using this particular exemption is a good practice because what it does is it keeps our rules consistent with the statute and up to date. And it's appropriate to use a very abbreviated procedure because, in fact, the agency has no discretion. There are no public policy considerations, and there are no controversies to discuss. So what does exempt rulemaking look like? I think others have touched upon it briefly, but there's no sonar, no public hearing, and a comment period isn't even required. What the process does require is a written explanation of how we've met the good cause exemption, and then in addition to that, the agency has to publish the rule in the state register. And so the ALJ's review is very limited. The ALJ is simply looking at whether the use of the exemption was appropriate and also the legality of the rule. Now, at DHS, once again, even for exempt rulemaking, we will exceed the requirements of the statute. We will commonly mail a notice to our stakeholders, and we will usually even afford a comment period. And the reason for that is by informing our stakeholders, it's an aid to their compliance with our rules. So those are the comments that I wanted to share with you this morning.
Mr. Chair, my name is Wendy Legg. I am the Chief Counsel for the Department of Labor and Industry. I wanted to first of all thank both Madam Chair and Mr. Chair for giving us the opportunity to present to the joint committees. The Department of Labor and Industry engages in rulemaking on a wide variety of topics. What I'd like to do is summarize the different rulemaking topics, the different ways in which we involve members of the public above and beyond the requirements of the formal rulemaking process. I prepared a handout for today. It's this handout that looks like this. It's a two-page handout, and the first page actually says summary of Department of Labor and Industry rulemaking activities. So on that page, it shows the different areas in which the department engages in rulemaking, and I've tried to make sure I include all of the current rulemaking that's going on in the department. The reverse side actually shows five different boards that are supported by the Department of Labor and Industry. Department provides the staff and the resources for rulemaking by these boards. Now, at the bottom of that second page that has the boards is also a description of the process used by Minnesota OSHA to adopt standards. And that's an example of one of those processes that is completely outside of Chapter 14. It's a streamlined process, not part of Chapter 14 rulemaking, and I'll discuss that in detail later. Most of the department's rulemaking involves the full rulemaking process that Patricia Winchett described under Chapter 14 of the Minnesota statutes. Now, as you know, that process includes a number of opportunities for public input. The department, as many other departments like DHS, goes above and beyond what's required by statute in order to obtain public input and develop the best possible rules in support of our mission. A good example is our development of the building code. The department relies heavily on input from regulated parties in developing these rules. The building code consists of many chapters of rules in specialized areas regarding building construction, such as Chapter 1305 on the International Building Code, Chapter 1309 on the International Residential Code. Now, for most of these chapters, the department has adopted a model code in a specialized area and has made amendments to that model code because amendments make sense for Minnesota construction. We have to take into account our winters here, for example. When we're interested in adopting a new or amended model code, what we do is we form an advisory committee in that specialized area. And you can see from the first page of the handout all the different committees that we currently have in connection with current Department of Labor and Industry rulemaking on the building code. The task of the advisory committee is to review the new model code and make recommendations to our commissioner regarding what changes, if any, should be made in Minnesota. Now, the advisory committee is chaired by a department employee who is an expert in that specialized area of the building code. Our advisory groups include people in the construction industry and people impacted by the rules, such as building owners or retailers. When we're forming an advisory group or advisory committee, it's the same thing, really. We contact trade groups and ask them for representatives for our committee. We sometimes also invite other interested parties. Now, here's a key piece of information I don't think anyone's mentioned. The members of these advisory committees, other than the department employee, receive no pay, no per diem, nada, nothing. They are entirely volunteers. The advisory committee meets as many times as needed to consider the model code and what changes are needed. Any member of the public can submit a suggested modification of the model code to the advisory committee. In fact, we have a form on our website for that purpose. It asks for the requested change, the requested amendment to the model code, the reason for the suggested change, and the information on the economic impact of the change. So we use that information to create the sonar that Judge Lippman's in love with. Although I don't know if he's in love with the building code sonars or not. We'll have to find that out. The committee then meets to consider the suggested changes and make recommendations to the department. Sometimes the advisory committees will have structural engineering issues that need to be considered by professional engineers, and that's why you'll see at the end of this list of committees for the building code, we also have a structural advisory committee. The department, again, unpaid except for department staff on the committee. The department asks this committee to deal with various structural engineering issues in our codes. And all of this work in rule development of the building code is done before the department publishes a proposed rule. At some point in the process, they publish a request for comments early on, but then all of this work takes place before we publish a proposed rule.
So I'd like now to turn to the rulemaking involving the boards, which, as I said before, is listed on the reverse side of the handout. When a board is involved in rulemaking, the board or a committee of the board has regular public meetings about the possible rule. These are all committee or board meetings that are subject to the open meeting law and are open to the public. For example, the department is currently working on workers' compensation treatment parameter rules. The Medical Services Review Board, in consultation with our department's medical consultant, who's a physician who works for our department, develops recommended rules. Long before any publication of a proposed rule, possible rules are discussed at the public board meetings. Another example is the rulemaking assistance that the department provides to all of the construction codes and licensing boards. So those are the top three boards listed here: Plumbing Board, Board of Electricity, Board of High Pressure Piping Systems. These boards have authority to promulgate the construction code in their designated area, such as the plumbing code, the electrical code, the high pressure piping code. These boards also have the authority to adopt rules on licensing or certification of individuals and businesses who perform work in the board's designated area, such as journeyman plumbers, master electricians, etc. There's a long list of professionals that are licensed under rules promulgated by these construction codes and licensing boards. Possible rule amendments within the jurisdiction of these boards are, again, discussed at board or committee meetings. For example, right now, the Plumbing Board has a National Code Review Committee that is currently considering the adoption of a National Model Plumbing Code with amendments. Okay, now there are two limited areas where the department regularly engages in an abbreviated process instead of the full rulemaking process. And these are rules which, as Judge Lippman said, they're rules where there is a need for speed. There's a need for speed in connection with this rulemaking. One area is the workers' compensation area, where we adopt amendments to the medical fee schedule based on the Medicare fee schedule. The workers' compensation statute sets out very specific criteria for regularly updating the medical fee schedule and for establishing the maximum fees. So, for instance, there's a very complicated formula to calculate maximum medical fees that can be charged to an employer in a workers' compensation setting. I can't figure it out. Luckily, we have people at the department who can figure it out. But one of those factors that is used in the equation is something called the conversion rate. The conversion rate by statute has to be published every year. So we have, for example, just published a conversion rate that is effective for medical treatment in workers' compensation cases, medical treatment on or after October 1st. Now, the workers' compensation statute allows the department to use the exempt rulemaking process for adopting these medical fee schedules, but it specifies that the rules adopted in this manner are permanent. So going back to Judge Lippman's chart, those are the exempt permanent rules that are excluded from that two-year limitation under statute. And the reason why they need to be permanent is because workers' compensation's liability for the medical treatment is not established right away. We may find out, 3 years down the road, more than that, after litigation, that the special compensation fund or an employer is responsible for paying for medical treatment that took place in a prior year. So that rule that you use to calculate the maximum medical fee needs to stay on the books. It doesn't make sense for that to be deleted from the rules after 2 years, because it may still be needed. With this process, this exempt process in the workers' compensation area, we're able to adopt amendments to the medical fee schedule in approximately 6 months. Similarly, Minnesota OSHA adopts standards using a process that is set out in the OSHA statute. Now, this is a special procedure in the OSHA statute only. The OSHA standards are exempt from the definition of a rule in Chapter 14. And this is important. There is a definite need for speed here, because under federal law, OSHA is required to adopt a standard in a particular area within 6 months of the time that federal OSHA issues the standard. Minnesota can either adopt the federal standard or develop its own standard. We could adopt a stricter standard. It has to be at least as strict as the federal standard. Ordinarily, we adopt the federal standard. So here's how that abbreviated process works for the adoption of OSHA standards. The department publishes a proposed rule adopting standards, and persons have 30 days to submit written comments and request for a hearing. There is almost never a need for a hearing. The people in the department can remember one hearing years back. If there are insufficient requests for a hearing, then the department has 60 days after the end of the comment period to publish a rule adopting the standard or to publish the department's determination that the rule should not be promulgated. We can delay the effective date of the rule for up to 90 days to allow time to educate affected employers and employees. This abbreviated process has worked exceedingly well for the department in the limited area of the adoption of OSHA standards. We are able to adopt one or two standards per year using this abbreviated process, and it usually only takes up to 2 or 3 months to adopt it. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much again for this opportunity to talk about department rulemaking.
Any questions for the testifiers? If not, thank you for your time. And next we have Ms. Carlson and Mr. Affeldt. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
It's pretty close. It's Offit.
Offit.
Funny Norwegian name.
Norwegian's okay. I could make a comment about Norwegians, but I won't.
There's two up here. Good afternoon, chairpersons, members. My name is Elizabeth Carlson. I am a strategic planning and policy administrator at the Department of Natural Resources, and one of my responsibilities is managing the DNR's portfolio of rulemaking activities. I have prepared a fact sheet on DNR rulemaking that all of you should have. It's got a DNR fact sheet logo at the top of it.
Did we get that?
The first page is just a very brief overview of DNR rulemaking. The second page outlines, in summary fashion, DNR's use of exempt and expedited processes in Chapter 14. And then on the third page is a chart of the 8 rulemaking processes that are available to DNR, including 3 that are unique to our agency, and I am going to spend a fair amount of my remarks on those. The names of all of these various processes are very similar, and I found that it can be confusing for people even who do rulemaking, and so I think that chart on the third page will be helpful to you as I go through my remarks. All the time, DNR is looking to match the best fit of process to the subject matter and the circumstances for any particular rulemaking and the statutory authorities that are available to us. In this presentation, I'll give you a quick orientation about our use of exempt and expedited processes. And I will start with the processes that are unique to DNR. As Mr. Marinak mentioned, the 1995 legislature repealed the authorities for game and fish and other emergency rulemaking that were in Chapter 14 and moved all of that language whole into Chapters 84 and 97. From what I can tell, there was no change to the language. It was simply moved into a different place in the statutes. And the DNR at that time also converted its previous system of using commissioner's orders for fish and wildlife activities into legislation and rules in order to increase public input for those rules and also to increase awareness of the regulations. So, emergency rulemaking today for the DNR. Sections 97A.0451 to 97A.0459 define an emergency rulemaking procedure for use when the DNR needs to adopt, amend, suspend, or repeal a rule in a manner that doesn't allow compliance with the full permanent rulemaking procedure in Chapter 14, or when the commissioner is expressly required or authorized by statute to adopt emergency rules. The intended purpose, as we understand it, is to allow the agency temporary regulatory authority until permanent rules can be promulgated, and with all of the time that that takes. Emergency rulemaking may only be used for a 180-day effective period and is renewable just once. DNR has used the emergency process just 3 times in the last 20 years that I've been able to find. In 2 years, in 1994 and in 2004, it was related to invasive species. And in 1999, it was used to close certain lakes to harvest following rehabilitation. The follow-on to permanent rulemaking varied in each of those instances because the situations continued to evolve. So the follow-on history there varies a little bit, but that was the original intention. So then we move to expedited emergency rulemaking for game and fish. In Section 84.027, Subdivision 13, we have the provision that for
expedited emergency game and fish rulemaking process. This is for use under conditions that do not allow the commissioner to comply with the requirements for a full emergency rulemaking. Expedited emergency game and fish rules are effective for up to 18 months, and generally we do them for a shorter period. The DNR uses expedited emergency rulemaking mainly for hunting and fishing rules that need to be set each season, year after year, and for species rules that need rapid handling. For example, every year the DNR gathers data for certain game species on a yearly basis and analyzes the data in order to set appropriate bag limits, season dates, hunting zones, and so forth. The DNR adopts an average of 19 expedited emergency rules every year. The DNR also uses the exempt and expedited rulemaking processes that are available in Chapter 14. And again, please refer to the notes that we have on the second page of our fact sheet for some additional remarks on those and how each process is best suited in certain circumstances. The DNR has limited authority to use the expedited permanent rulemaking process in 14.389, and we've only had it for a few years. This process is faster mainly because no request for comments publication is required and a sonar does not have to be prepared. DNR's authority for this process also does not require a hearing option, so that's another time saver. DNR uses this process to address matters of urgency and also to put into permanent rule things that were previously addressed in expedited emergency rules, but now they've sort of settled and no longer meet the conditions for needing that expedited emergency process. A current example has to do with the lists of prohibited and regulated invasive species. For two or three years, we've done an expedited emergency rule adding species to that list. There was an expedited emergency rule adding species to the list a year ago. That was effective September 4th of 2012. Adding faucet snails and other species to those lists was a quick response to make the transport of those species illegal and to help prevent their spread. And now the DNR is undertaking an expedited permanent rulemaking to make those list changes permanent. The same urgency of the conditions remains to be the case. Moving on to good cause exemption in 14.388, DNR's main use of that type of rulemaking process has been to, as others have mentioned, amend rules to conform with statutory changes. And those, from my observation, tend to be very specific, very small rulemakings. This process favors email notice because the comment period is just 5 days from the date of submitting our rule change to the Office of Administrative Hearings. And obviously, it's best suited for things that are non-controversial. We have several examples just from the most recent 2013 session that will be addressed through good cause exemption rulemaking, including possession and transportation of wildlife affected by oil spills. There was a specific statutory change in that topic where we need to conform the rule. Other topics included game fish eggs as bait, restitution value for sandhill cranes, spearing of rough fish, and display of paddleboard license numbers. In each of those cases, the statutory change was very specific. The DNR knows exactly what it has to do, and the rule change will mimic the statutory change. It's very straightforward, and we have no discretion. We need to make the rule match the statute change. There was one interesting, different one 2 years ago, where we were authorized by the legislature to use good cause exemption to make the change. And this was a change to where DNR had a rule banning the taking of fish by spearing on Cass Lake. And there was a statutory change requiring the DNR to remove that ban, which was, in rulemaking, just a simple repealer. This happened to be a topic where there were polarized interests among the public, and we understand that the Office of Administrative Hearings received 54 comments on this report, this change, right within that 5-day period for comments. But we had no room to maneuver. We had to match the rule
to the statutory change. And so in that case, the public comment, while of great interest, was not something that could affect our rulemaking in that way. If there was something about the rulemaking that where we didn't have proper statutory authority or some of those other requirements that have been mentioned, that would have been another thing. But it was, in fact, a simple matter of conforming to statute. Finally, DNR's designation of experimental and special management waters is done under two sections of Chapter 97C, .001 and .005. Those designations are fully exempt from Chapter 14 and from Section 14.386, but they are still rules. The authority in the fisheries law prescribes an alternate procedure that the DNR has to follow to adopt these exempt permanent rules, including public notice and a meeting at the local level. So in closing, I just want to say that the DNR places a high value on consulting with the public, and I would say ditto to the other remarks that have been offered by other rules coordinators and representatives from the agencies. Much of our rulemaking is informed by ongoing interactions and relationships with a widely varied and very active and interested citizenry and business community, along with any specific public input that we may pursue and receive during a formal rulemaking. Our stakeholders and interested publics cover a wide range of interests, values, and perspectives, and that's always something that we have to take into account. We strive to adopt rules that are necessary and reasonable to carry out the responsibilities of the agency's public mission. And we do absolutely care about how DNR rules affect people, businesses, and local government units. We listen to the range of information and wisdom that they contribute. We are looking for good ideas to make rules better and more workable, and we do care about their needs, concerns, and hopes where rulemaking is concerned. A voice of wisdom may come unexpectedly from different quarters, and it can indeed help make better rules. That has, in fact, happened where we have made adjustments to rules, not only during rule development, but during from public comments that have come in. And we value that possibility going forward in DNR rulemaking. Our objectives for rulemaking are to be guided by both science and by being informed by public participation, and to go about it in a responsible and responsive manner, including using the most efficient process that is appropriate to the subject matter and its public policy context, and also with the proper statutory authority. So I thank you for your time this afternoon, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Any questions for Ms. Carlson? Here's your chance, Representative Hansen.
Well, since you prompted me.
Well, your earlier question, I guess.
I know you've gone through the statutes, but it just, you know, seems every year we have to come to this committee because we have, I'm wondering if there's some type of blanket exemption or some type of criteria that we can do on the more routine type of things, such as you mentioned, or maybe it already exists, and we're
Ms. Carlson.
And chairpersons, Representative Hansen. Of course, we're looking for efficiencies all the time and want to make good use of both staff time and the public's time. It'd be helpful to look at specific examples, and then we'd be better able to determine if we are using the most effective and efficient available processes, or if we need something new, and we'd be interested in looking at that.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and I think to give an example, you look at the memo of Mr. Shepard. You've got the restitution value on sandhill cranes and the use of bait, game fish eggs as bait. That's a little different than the Mississippi Critical Corridor River rulemaking. There's kind of a different scale there in terms of things. Not that game fish eggs as bait may not be controversial, but it seems like those are the latter, the game fish eggs as bait, are what we see more. We just see a variety of those coming forward, where usually when we're having the hearings, we don't have a lot of testimony about those type of things. And maybe they do need to come in front of the committee and we need to debate them. But there just seems to be a intensity factor whether or not those fit into asking for an exemption all the time. Because it would seem that under general commissioner's authority, you could set the restitution value, or we could set the standards here, mm-hmm. the criteria that you would use for setting restitution value, mm-hmm. Whenever there's a new game animal or fish. That's what I'm reacting to, and I think other members have had those questions as well when they come to this committee or when they are going through, oh, we've got to send it to government operations. Maybe it's just a good government thing that we need to do. Mm-hmm. But I'd like your opinion on that.
Ms. Carlson.
And Chairpersons, Representative Hansen. It sounds like it's worth looking into further. One thing that's on that list in the fact sheet on the last page that's listed at the top is commissioner's orders, mm-hmm. which are that there's some standard phrasing when we request commissioner's order authority that authorizes the commissioner to take an action by written order, sometimes with publication in the state register and with a complete exemption from rulemaking. I'm not an attorney, but it's my understanding that we could not use a commissioner's order to amend a rule. So that would be one one barrier to from going that far with it. If there is some other way that we can find to be writing the session laws to try to make these things even more straightforward, I think we'd be interested in taking a look at that. Again, I'm not an attorney, so I'm probably not the best to weigh in on exactly how that might be done.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on a kind of a different track, and not just your agency, but the other agencies that have testified, we often just routinely talk and refer to stakeholders. And so stakeholders can be lobbyists or special interests or interested members of the public. And I'm not focusing solely on you, because everyone who's here who has or who probably will testify talks about bringing the stakeholders together. And I think the challenge is who speaks for the public interest when you are bringing the stakeholders together, because if you impanel an advisory group that are, particularly if they're the lobbyists who are paid to be there to represent an interest versus the general public who, as was mentioned earlier, isn't exactly reading through the state register all the time. Now, with the internet and with more transparency, we have more people following things, but who's there to advocate for the public if the interests are there? They may not be compensated through per diem, but maybe they're being compensated by the interest mm-hmm. to be there on that advisory committee. What protections are there for the public when we're going through the public process?
Ms. Carlson.
Chairpersons, Representative Hansen. I'm going to make a pitch for really good public participation practices, which is one of my areas of interest in my work and something I've been involved with for some time. The DNR actually does not make frequent use of the advisory committee technique. That is but one of many public participation techniques that are in the toolbox for involving all the variety of stakeholders and interested parties that you mentioned and beyond. And sometimes, in our estimation, an advisory committee is not necessarily the best way to develop the rules that need to be done in a very public and transparent way and to provide the kind of extensive access that you're talking about. So it's something that we encourage our staff in the agency to do, is take a good, long, hard look at what are the circumstances, what are the interests, what sort of public participation strategy, and not just relying on one tool, do we need to use to be effective and to be open and fair and inclusive with the whole range of interests when we're working on these types of things.
Representative Hansen. Mm-hmm.
Does the legislature need to say, when we're having advisory committees or when we're having stakeholder groups, that there has to be a general public representative there, or perhaps having local governments or somebody who has an election certificate who is accountable to the general public needs to be at least in the loop on this? And I'm not asking for members of the legislature to be sitting on every advisory group, but I think particularly when, and I worked in state government before I was elected. I think you have familiarity and affinity with the folks that you interact with regularly, who know the nomenclature of each in any agency, know the nomenclature of the rules or the law. Mm-hmm. But the general public, which is constantly changing, but may be affected, doesn't have that access. And who, and to get back to that question, who speaks for them when you impanel, or when you're having these efforts, or when you have the meetings during the work hours, mm-hmm. when people are working? Do we need to provide for more electronic? We've provided for legislative participation by phone and committee meetings. Mm-hmm. We did that recently. Do we need to do that for rulemaking? Do we need to provide that the public can participate in a variety of ways to make it easier for the general public? And I'll go back to what I'd asked earlier, you know, Minnesotans versus the whole world. Mm-hmm. If we can have the whole world participate, but we lose participation of the general public in Minnesota, what's the end product that we get? And I realize that's a potential. I'd like both of you to maybe answer that.
Ms. Carlson.
Chairperson's Representative Hansen, there is not a simple answer to that question in my estimation, so I'm not going to start speculating and rambling on here on the ifs, ands, and maybes. Those are ongoing challenges for the practice of public participation, whether it's for rulemaking or any other public policy activity that or public management activity that agencies undertake. I think that unless somebody comes up with an idea I haven't heard of yet, I think that agencies ought to be already making use of the variety of technologies and techniques that are available, and I don't think there's anything in the Administrative Procedures Act that prevents agencies from doing that. The rule development process is pretty wide open for agencies to design their processes and their interactions with the public, and it's really their obligation, I think, to do that in an up-to-date and open way. When it gets into the more formal processes, there is an option that some agencies have already used for video conferencing with hearings and so forth, and I think DNR has done that at times in the past, or at least offered the option if people were interested. And there may be a ways that we could go in experimenting, but I'm not aware off the top of my head of us being held back by that aspect.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Carlson, and Mr.
Offit.
Offit, okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is David Offit. I'm with the law firm of Winthrop & Weinstein. I practice in our firm's regulatory and legislative practice group over there. And after, I've been there for 10 years. Before that, from 1995 to 2003, I had the good fortune of being at the Minnesota Attorney General's office representing a number of the state agencies and served with some of the very capable folks that have already testified here before you today. My colleagues have very capably summarized the various processes, but I do want to address a couple of questions that have already been asked and make a couple of additional points and extensions. And if I may, Mr. Chair, I'd like to address Representative Hansen's question on the individuals and who may and may not in terms of Minnesotans. There certainly is nothing in the Administrative Procedure Act that would address that requirement for the number of individuals necessary to request a hearing. As you may be aware, a number of licensees in Minnesota, real estate agents, salespersons, brokers, insurance agents, insurance companies are not Minnesota residents. And so that would be somewhere where that would definitely come up. Back to my prepared remarks, if I may. Addressing some of the points that have been made, while rulemaking can and, in fact, indeed is a laborious process, it is a vital process to ensure that the individuals whose rights and duties are impacted by agency actions have, at a minimum, the opportunity to shape the state laws that impact him, her, or it. The alternative to that would be you folks drilling down into these painfully excruciating details over the course of your very abbreviated sessions, and I'm guessing that is not palatable to any of you folks. With respect to the participation that's been a very important issue that's been discussed today, I would suggest that perhaps even more time be taken to ensure that those parties, the members of the public, and certainly all licensees or those impacted by a regulation, registrants, for example, be invited to participate with a particular focus on those early stages at the solicitation of comment stage, the advisory committee stage. Representative Hansen and others have addressed the issue today about who are the stakeholders, who are the participants for ensuring that the public interest is protected. Who reads the state register? Just geeks like me and some of us other administrative law folks that do that on a weekly basis, but most people don't. Most licensees have no idea what a rule is, frankly. And in fact, that carries the same force and effect as what you folks do up here at the legislature. So I would certainly encourage expanding the agency's outreach efforts and taking advantage of the new media, electronic communications with the licensees. Every licensee is required, from to my knowledge, to provide email addresses, and that certainly is a very easy way to make sure that notice is at least given and comments solicited from those individuals. Second, the legislature and the agencies themselves need to remain vigilant, and again, this is one of the reasons we are here today, to ensure that they do not take the quick and easy way out. And I'm not suggesting they do, but the expedited rulemaking process is tempting, and I always encourage folks to guard against expedited rulemaking creep, as I describe it. It's natural to do things the easier, quicker way, and all other things being equal. But when it comes to creating the laws that impact individuals and businesses the way rules do, the easy, quick way should never be the default when due process and substantive rights are at issue. Again, back to the solicitation of comments and notice of intent to adopt. It should be, in fact, must be published to all licensees, not only those who sign up for the rulemaking list. Again, those rulemaking lists tend to become a little too comfortable, as Representative Hansen was suggesting earlier. And it's people like me who have clients that I work with on a daily basis, for example, before state agencies, that are on those lists. It is not published widely enough, and I would encourage agencies. And in fact, many of them probably do. Some of the agencies that I work with, though, I know do not, and the lists are much more limited. Again, as I pointed out, while I have not polled my clients from every single industry that is out there, most of the licensees have no idea what rules are or how they can impact them so dramatically. And again, while trade associations do certainly play an important part of representing the interests of all of the individuals that might make it up, at the same time, there also may be circumstances where individuals, licensees, physicians, dentists, for example, are not members. Circumstances where individuals, licensees, physicians, dentists, for example, are not members of their respective trade associations and may have very important contributions to make. And as Ms. Carlson suggested, I think that agencies do a good job of trying to make that outreach effort, but more widespread publication, electronic communications are certainly one way to achieve that. And again, we've heard before, too many cooks in the kitchen, too long of a process, and I want to share one quick example that was actually legislative, and I think it is consistent with what Ms. Sheffer had shared with us today from DHS. This most recent recent legislative session, I had the opportunity to work with a consortium of opiate treatment providers, and we worked very cooperatively with DHS and the Inspector General's Office, Mr. Jerry Kerber, the legislative liaison, Patrick Carter. And the end result was a bill that was passed and signed into law, and it was the product of good collaboration by licensees and the regulators, so that there were no surprises, whether throughout the process or at the end, now that they're going to be implemented. And so, again, I think the agencies strive for that. That is collaboration and more participation, more widespread participation is always in the public interest. Fourth, the legislature may wish to consider broadening, and I'm not sure what the reception of this may be from Judge Lippman or Chief Judge Pust, who is here today, but may wish to consider broadening the authority of the Office of Administrative Hearings and its able bench to evaluate the substance of proposed rules under consideration rather than just the technical aspects. As one former ALJ has shared with me, OAH is a fine filter for technical and procedural matters, such as legality and reasonableness, but it is not a substance or stupid filter. That was what was shared with me by a former judge. So I thought that was interesting and something that I would share with the committee today. Fifth, agencies, as many of you know well, make laws by contested case proceedings or by rulemaking. And as they say, bad facts make bad law, and even worse actors with bad facts make even worse law. And I think that everyone would agree that as a matter of public policy, we prefer thoughtful consideration be given to extensions or substantive interpretations of the law, which is what, in many cases, rulemaking, in fact, is. And the key is substantive input. And again, 18 months, I know, can seem like a long time, and it's a lot of work for the agency folks, but the end result is a better result. As Judge Lippman has shared with you today, as Ms. Sheffer, as others have shared with you, it's much better than the alternative. Litigation and battles with licensees and regulated parties can be extraordinarily expensive, and in the end, it is a benefit to everybody, both the regulators and the regulated community. And lastly, we need to not only focus on where these rule proceedings are going, but also where they have been. And this touches a bit on what Mr. Marinac was saying. What I mean by that is that there are many rules on the books for which the underlying enabling legislation no longer exists, or there's question as to whether it ever did exist. That is based upon my research on a number of different matters and discussions I've had with other folks. And the other issue is when different enabling legislation was enacted prior to the authority that it presently exists, and whether or not it is ever referenced or incorporated into the new laws, continuing on with the authority to enforce those rules, and the issue when these record-making rules no longer exist. In those situations, it's impossible to discern what the intent was for the rule. We had no sonar. We had no substantive process. These things were just created. Frankly, in some situations, it appears out of thin air, although I'm sure that wasn't the case, but there's no background or documentation, no equivalent of legislative history to turn back to. In representing interests in regulated parties before the agencies in those situations, as you can imagine, becomes extremely difficult because, as many of you know, one of the hallmarks of administrative law is that deference is accorded to agency interpretations of its own laws. Or their own laws, I should say. And so when we have that going against us, that can be a problem. In that vein, I also wanted to share with you a comment from a former chief ALJ who shared with me that he and participants in a fairly recent rulemaking ran into this specific issue. They were looking at extensions, from what I understand, of existing rules, and they were trying to track down what the heck was going on in the prior rulemaking proceeding, and it predated the administrative rules being enacted and incorporated or put into administrative rules, the new published volumes. It was the MCAR version, as they are referred to, and they couldn't track it down. They had no ability to track down what the intent was originally, or the scope of the intent of those rules. This, as you mentioned earlier, Mr. Chair, this perhaps could be on the inventory or list of action items for the governor's upcoming unsession, if you will, to repeal or reconfirm whatever the case might be, the validity of these rules that sit out there without any clear agency intent or, frankly, legislative intent. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions any of you may have.
Any questions for Mr. Offalt?
Offit.
Offit. I'll get it right someday.
No worries.
My only question or statement would be, if you can give us a list of some of those things you're talking about, they'd probably have to go through the, if they're laws, they might have to go through the other committees, but I mean, that's kind of what we're looking for here too, is ways that we can make things work better in the state of Minnesota, and I think that's what the governor's intent with his unsession is to figure out ways. In some ways, I think he's channeling former Representative Biskins, who always talked about making the law books smaller and than they are. But thank you for your testimony.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
I want to erase that from the tape before the governor hears it.
Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If it's possible, and I do believe that Mr. Lippman is here, I'd like to just have him come back. I have a couple of questions for him.
Judge Lippman, would you?
Vice Chair of the Administrative Law Section?
I'll pass. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Judge Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Eric Lippman. I'm an administrative law judge at OAH. Representative, how can I help, Representative?
Well, Mr. Chair, one of the concerns that I had, and it was back in session because there were a number of bills that came through with rulemaking exceptions, and I want to thank you for having this hearing today to be able to provide members some clarity and some information on this. As I sat here this afternoon listening to testimony and listening to the rationale, we had some pretty big legislation that came through this year. Deed had some things that came through that had expedited rulemaking on there. We also have the health care exchange, now known as MnSure, that has come through, highly controversial, probably heard that in three different committees. And that also had expedited rulemaking. From your perspective, Mr. Lippman, has the public been better served, equally served, or lesser served as a result of those expedited rulemaking? Particularly with MnSure. I mean, we're starting to hear a lot about that, and maybe it's gone too fast and some of those types of things. And,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Driscoll, I think that each of those stories has a policy backdrop, and as I've moved from a member who had a jersey with a particular team to wearing all black, I guess I don't weigh in on the policy questions. I'm content to have the people here in this room do that, and because you do that quite well. I not to dodge the question, because I do think there is an underlying substantive answer, and one of the reasons why I wanted members to have the chart is I think that there is a still wider discussion that you can have with agency members in the main when they come and say, we would like a different rulemaking option other than ordinary rulemaking. Okay, and my suggestion is I think that there is a wider palette of options, and that you can have a meaningful an iterative discussion back and forth exchange with agency stakeholders about what need they're trying to get or satisfy by not just going through rulemaking. It could well be cost. It could well be speed. It could well be a variety of different factors. And my message to members of the legislature is there are opportunities to be creative. You have a wide palette, and I don't think that the options aren't necessarily either ordinary rulemaking and all of its bells and whistles, or do as you wish and please do a good job. I think that there are a wide range of options, and that there should be detailed, sophisticated, and thoughtful discussions about why the exemptions, if they are needed, and many times they are, why they're needed, and exactly what is hoping to be accomplished. And so, because you run the show, and it's your delegation, it could be conditioned in any way that you well see fit, certainly within constitutional boundaries. That's a big palette to draw upon. I think that you can have a wide-ranging and robust set of conversations with agencies, and I would urge you to do so, because it doesn't necessarily have to fit into these small silos. If you have a concern that certain stakeholders aren't being reached, I think you can condition the rulemaking authority on reaching those folks and drawing them into the process. Again, I spoke earlier about the immunization rules, and I thought that statute was really unique among the statute books in the powers it accorded to the Department of Health and also the conditions that it put on. And so I think that followed from a high-level, very sophisticated, a very nuanced set of regulations, and you can right-size it toward the needs. In this area, because of these stakeholders and this history, we do this process. In some other area where there's less concern or less worry, we do another process. And we pay you the big dollars, and I say that tongue-in-cheek, having had one of those salaries for a time. But we give you the responsibility and the honor and the respect of being able to serve, because we trust, and I do trust, your judgment in those matters. And you're just the people to right-size these delegations.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Mr. Chair, two reasons why I asked Mr. Lippman to come back is, as we look at the list of testifiers today, I appreciate each of them coming to us today. But each of them, if you will, have had a horse in the race on this. If I'm looking back at the list of agencies that are here, I can almost without exception remember seeing something in the form of a bill that came before our committee here that asked for something in the way of exceptions to rulemaking. And so when you threw down the phrase that seems to be the phrase of the afternoon, the need for speed, that came to the top of the list for me. We created a brand new bureaucracy in order to expedite rulemaking, this brand new bureaucracy. And so we have something that Minnesota needs to get its arms around, plus we're going to go faster in the rulemaking process. And I won't ask the question again, because as you said, you're not going to answer if it's too hot, too cold, just right.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Driscoll, let me just write that. As to whether the choices that the legislature made in the Minshew case, that's not something that I do want to approach. What I do want to urge members, and just so that I can be clear about it, to really think about, is there may well be the need for speed, but do you need it two years out? And if the answer to that is no, well, then maybe the exempt for two-year option is something to talk about. And I think if you think about it in what problem are we trying to solve, and I think most members come here genuinely animated by public service and they want to solve problems, is that you can, in fact, have a thorough and rigorous and helpful dialogue with agencies, and to make those balancing, which is, okay, well, we'll give you the need for speed, we'll respond to that right now, but we do want you to go back and do this through the ordinary process so that we can build public confidence. And I think most agencies would respond well to that. And so if I do have a message, it is to broaden the palette, would be one. And two, you are exactly the people who we want to engage in this discussion, because everyone in the process is looking to you, not only to be careful in the delegations as they occur in the first place, but to make sure that when exceptions are needed to be made, that this committee and these committees are making the right calls. Because if you're on commerce or if you're on Health and Human Services policy, GovOps and StateGov, they're doing it. You know, and if you'll ask your colleagues, well, when we send it to you, we're trusting you'll sort it out. And so thank you for taking the time, and please engage. And we want to play a helpful and supportive role to encourage and support you, because what you do is critically, critically important.
Mr. Chair. And again, I just, this had been something that various times throughout the session we had that, and I just wanted to ask that question in retrospect and what we've done, where we've created the new bureaucracy. And again, Judge Lippman, it was not to put you on the hot seat, but as you pointed out, you're kind of maybe wearing the referee stripes compared to some of the other players that are on the list here.
I'm just balls and strikes.
So that's why I asked you the question, because I would suspect that I would have gotten reiterations of testimony that were given why during committee the exceptions were needed, and it seems like the exception this year was we don't want to do rulemaking the way we've always done it. So that's again why we're here today, I think. So thank you, Judge.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Driscoll, you have options, great options.
Thanks for the members for coming and asking the questions. And members of the House, there's a blue sheet in your packet. Get it filled out and turned into Mr. Geldman so that we can, if you want to get your per diem. And with that, thanks to all the members of the public that were here also. With that, this meeting is adjourned.